there are three times as many Chinese restaurants in this country as there are McDonald's. But at one point, they were almost outlawed because of a Chicago effort.
So if you wanted to be free from the strict laws of society at that time, you went to a Chinese restaurant.
That's WBEZ Chicago and Chewing podcast co-host Monica Ng. Her co-host, the Chicago Tribune's Louisa Chu, take us out for Chop Suey and Egg Foo Young to discuss the history of Chinese restaurants in the Midwest. Plus, poet Daniel Borzutsky's latest work is much more direct and political than in years past. And he says the 2016 election is a big reason why.
There's, I guess, a feeling of not wanting, maybe wanting to match that rhetoric with a rhetoric which is direct.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stick around. We'll get started just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Earlier this week, I sat down with food writers and radio hosts Monica Ng from WBEZ Chicago and Louisa Chu from the Chicago Tribune. They both co-host the podcast Chewing. They also both grew up in Chicago in the world of Chinese restaurants. As you'll hear in a minute, both Monica and Louisa's families owned and operated Chinese restaurants, and both journalists recently wrote pieces about their food heritages for the Chicago Tribune. So I wanted to invite them to sit down to eat at a quintessential Chinese-American spot to talk about different styles of Chinese cuisine, whether or not chop suey is authentic, and of course, what makes a good egg roll. Here we are at Lee's Chop Suey, which opened in 1968 in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. What are we going to get?
Well, I'm thinking definitely some chop suey, chow mein, egg foo young, and maybe even sweet and sour pork. What do you guys think?
I for sure need to get the egg rolls because they are the classic, what I'm calling Chicago-style Midwestern egg rolls with peanut butter in the ingredients. Fried shrimp for sure, which I'm guessing is going to be like the sort of puffy, breaded Cantonese fried shrimp. So far, those are my main things, but yeah.
Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, so you have regular egg roll, three of it, one vegetable egg roll, and one shrimp fried rice, and one graham corn, which is the six pieces, mushroom egg foo young, and one shrimp fried rice, which is small size, and one chicken chow mein, which is a crispy one, and also the Chinese chop suey. So the egg foo young is mushroom egg foo young. So,
right. Okay.
That be all?
I think that's
yes.
A lot of food.
Okay. All right.
So Monica Ng and Louisa Chu are here. Can both of you share, Monica, do you want to start the story of your family's Chinese restaurant in Chicago?
Sure. Actually, my great-grandpa, Joe Ng, came to Quincy, Illinois, which has been in the news lately, in about 1909. He had laundries there and then came to Chicago and started opening restaurants. He had some takeout joints in East Garfield Park, as well as a giant, world's largest Chinese cafe called the Golden Pumpkin, also in East Garfield Park, where he had jazz bands and three stories of restaurants. Until 1929, and he lost it all in the Great Depression and started up again in 1933 with Hosai Gai, House of Ang, a bunch of other restaurants in the Chicago area and Chicago.
Louisa, what about your family?
So can I first say that Monica always seems to downplay the fact that her family's restaurants were a dynasty, that she is a descendant, albeit perhaps undeserving, of this incredible restaurant dynasty.
No.
Hosai Gai was unlike and perhaps will be unlike any other Chinese restaurant in history. It was this spectacular Art Deco masterpiece, which the building is completely torn down, is now Daley Plaza here in Chicago. And you can still see pictures of postcards online. I mean, and they each had themed rooms, each one which was more exquisite than the other. Later on, the Empire included some of the most spectacular, also tiki cocktail restaurants, which had one of the restaurants had one of the first Asian key clubs, which were modeled after the Playboy rooms of a different era.
Basically, you could be entertained by women,
right.
Very beautiful women. Mm. One of our restaurants was pretty much two doors down from the Playboy Club on Walton. And my relatives were seeing these long lines outside the Playboy Club and saying, hey, why not have some gorgeous ladies at our place, too. So we had Hung Fa Village, which specialized in that. We had the Key Clubs in the House of Angs, too.
So we're at Lee's Chop Suey. What kind of style Chinese restaurant would you characterize this as?
Rec room.
This old school.
Is, this is like late 1960s, 1970s era, dark wood paneling, rec room, kind of, you know, with
red lanterns, yep. Chinese art.
Can you explain what Cantonese style restaurants would be like?
So my family restaurants were chop suey, Cantonese style chop suey, which really came around during the same time that these did, you know, late 1960s, 1970s, where they served some of the classic mid-century modern chop suey, chow mein, Hong Kong steak. Also then started to add in, though, pan-fried noodles, because that was actually sort of a more, I should say, late-era Cantonese introduction to Chicago-style Midwestern Chinese restaurants. Mild sauces, it is generally...
Not to be confused with mild sauce on Chicago's south side that you get
no.
in places like Harold's. Different.
Completely different. But
oh, well, or a tea's coming. And then Lazy Susan is a must. We have a Lazy Susan in the middle of the table.
The Chinese chop suey, which is the barbecue pot mixed with the vegetables.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you. Needs hot tea on a cold night like tonight.
So there's actually a little bit of an evolution too, because these chop suey restaurants really did start out by serving Chinese American but Cantonese style food, whereas now there's now a next generation of Cantonese style food, which is serving foods that you will find in the southern coastal region of Guangdong, previously known as Canton, and Hong Kong-style food. So, for example, in Chicago, Ming Hin is a restaurant that serves Cantonese kai or chai. Also in Chinatown serves what I call fancy Cantonese, with these big banquet rooms and dim sum. And, you know, so
elaborate
there's...
elaborate seafood dishes.
Yeah. Where they have, like, the 26-course
right.
Lunar New Year meals.
Abalone. Mm-hmm.
So would you consider, and I don't know if this is the right word, do you consider this authentic, or what word would you use?
Well, there's been a lot of debate over that. And what I say is, when a cuisine's been around for more than, let's say, 115 years, it's a real cuisine. Is it exactly what our ancestors ate in Canton? Probably not.
It's really hard. We actually just published a guide to Chinatown, and I addressed the question of authentic, because we know what people mean, and I wrote about that and said, you know, I know what you mean, and for lack of a better word yet, we're going to use authentic, you know, but yeah.
So by authentic, we mean not American? Is that what that's what people mean when they say authentic?
They don't want
things that have an American style or influence?
When I hear authentic, I think this is what people from this country ate back home.
But I think that it's such a broad general term when it comes to food. I mean, it's like there's authentic African-American food, which is clearly of this country and was nothing like, or actually very little like African food, but it's clearly a cuisine that is of this country. And as far as time is concerned, I mean, we have now a lot of dishes that were created here that have a shorter lifespan. I mean, I think about like sort of a lot of the mashups, like Mexican snack foods and street foods, which were developed out of a lot of the, you know, streets and street foods and bodegas here in the U.S. So authentic is a tough one, you know. I don't know. We don't know what the better word is for that, but like real, genuine, authentic. We know what you mean. I have a tough time with what's authentic or not.
But if you're asking, is this what people ate in Canton before they left? Nope, not what we ate. Let's say with egg rolls. I did a story for the Tribune about these chubby cabbage and shrimp and pork plus peanut butter egg rolls. And I asked my great aunt, Fanny Goh, is this the kind of thing you ate when you were in Canton? She said there was nothing like this there. If you had anything sort of like it, it was the spring roll, a thin little delicate roll that they would serve during the spring festival, also known as Chinese New Year.
The egg rolls are coming.
Speak of the devil, here they are. Look at these gorgeous,
these are beautiful,
blistered, golden, chubby things. All right, and the sauces. So usually in the United States, you get sweet and sour sauce plus a mustard sauce made with Coleman's English mustard. How Cantonese is that? Well, because the British were in China.
Thank you.
Oh, what is that?
Oh, that's a French shrimp.
Oh, that's a shrimp. They look like little donuts.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay. And this is
the crab rangoon. Yes. Okay. So this is, I feel like, our fried course has come. Who wants to tell us history of where egg rolls came from then?
Okay, so you don't see egg rolls on menus until, I'd say, mid-century. And actually, it was thought that these types of egg rolls were created in New York and then came here. Louisa likes to refer to them as Midwest style. I don't know. But what you see in China is something called a spring roll, much more slender and delicate with a thinner wrapper served at the Spring Festival, also known as Lunar New Year. Crab Rangoon, 1956, Trader Vic's. I recently had someone tell me that he invented it in Saginaw, Michigan in the 70s, but you can't fool historical documents. Trader Vic's was one of the tiki restaurants that grew up out of the post-World War II era when all the GIs were coming home. They'd been exposed to Polynesia and South Pacific. The musical had come out, and everybody was thinking about these exotic girls and these exotic umbrella drinks. And so my great uncle and my grandfather opened up a restaurant on Randolph right next to the Oriental Theater called South Pacific. Trader Vic's was a restaurant in the Palmer House.
Did everybody try the egg roll?
Not yet.
Louisa.
I know.
They wanted to come up with all of these exotic dishes. So they had these flaming dishes, these poo-poo platters, and crab rangoon was one of the dishes that came out of it, and it sounds very, very exotic.
All right, I'm going to try the egg roll first.
What's the verdict?
Mm-hmm. What's the verdict?
It's a good one. I like how the strands of cabbage still have a little bit of crunch in them. Sometimes some of the newer ones are completely really fine cut or almost a paste in the middle. A pretty good fry in these. Really nice distinctive savory tone from the peanut butter, which is noticeable but not too overwhelming. I've had it.
Why peanut butter?
Nyla, that is the eternal question.
You said this is the 12th egg roll you've had in the past week.
Actually, this might be the 12th place, so I've had a lot of egg rolls.
And how far have you gone in this egg roll quest? Where have you gone?
So far, the biggest trip that I took on hitting the egg roll trail, I went out west and drove about 200 miles round trip out to DeKalb and Rockford. In DeKalb, there's a restaurant called Pho and Grill, and then in Rockford, there is a restaurant called Lung Fung Number 2. It's very important to distinguish that it's the number 2 in Rockford. And both of those restaurants have egg rolls that are descendants of the Pekin House restaurant in Chicago on Devon Avenue, closed in 2012, I believe it was. One of the two sort of most beloved long-lost egg rolls in the Chicago area. Very different, though. Pekin House was closer to the egg rolls here at Lee's, which is more sort of like the classic golden, somewhat the similar style of the familiar tubular Chinese American appetizer, whereas Cow Cow was very different because it was batter dipped before it was double fried.
And then you were explaining why peanut butter?
So that's the big existential question. Why is there peanut butter? It is this question about cultural identity. I've heard a lot of different theories, some that peanut butter was used to seal the wrappers, others that it was used as a binding ingredient, that it was a filler during World War II rationing time, and others simply because it was just for flavoring. So I tracked down the man that I thought invented the Chinese American, what I call the Chicago style egg roll of peanut butter, and I can't tell you yet, Nyla. I'm sorry.
We are anxiously awaiting Louisa Chu's Chicago Tribune story that will answer the mystery of why peanut butter was in Midwestern egg rolls. You just heard some of a conversation I had with Louisa Chu and Monica Ng over dinner earlier this week at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago. We'll share some pictures of our meal over social media and on our website, 21stshow.org. We also have been asking you to tell us about your favorite Chinese restaurant in your part of the state. Tori wrote on Facebook that, quote, best egg rolls are from Grand's Cafe in Bloomington. The original Grand Cafe closed, but they moved to Grand Cafe Express on Oakland Avenue. And she added, yes, they're made with peanut butter. Want to tell us about your fave? Tweet us or talk to us on Facebook at 21ST Show. We'll be back in a minute here on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Nyla, my name is Barbara. I heard you were doing a show on Chinese food, and I graduated from the U of I, and when I go back there to visit, I always like to go to Bobo China. I really enjoy the Mongolian lamb and their stir-fried beef with the rice noodles. Thanks a lot. Great show. Bye.
Hi, my name is Matthew from Bloomington, Illinois, and I'm calling about my favorite Chinese restaurant, the Orient Gourmet. I think it is classic Chinese food done really well. Their crab rangoon is my go-to appetizer. The beef with broccoli is my go-to main dish. And just about everything else is really, really good. So I'm recommending the Orient Gourmet. Thanks and great show.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. And today we're bringing you a fun conversation I had earlier this week with Chicago Tribune food writer Louisa Chu and WBEZ reporter Monica Ng. These two know their Chinese food and their Chinese American history, and so I invited them out to eat at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago's Northwest Side. We'll tweet out links to articles that Monica and Louisa have written about this, and this is a conversation on their podcast Chewing, but let's get back to our conversation. This is the crispy noodle. This is supposed to go on top of the chop suey?
So traditionally, that is the old school. The good thing is that that's the old school chow mein noodles, and people will recognize it as being like I was saying, looks like fried pieces of spaghetti.
Louisa, do you know the difference between Chinese chop suey, fine-cut chop suey, and regular chicken chop suey?
I've never had chop suey or egg fuya.
I'm guessing that the fine-cut pork chop suey is going to be different than like what is considered a classic American or Midwestern style pork chop suey, which is like usually chunks. So like the really classic old school mid-century modern chop suey was chunks of pork and celery.
Actually, chop suey was served in all of the cafeterias of downtown Chicago at the beginning of the 20th century. Fritzl's had it. Basically, every cafeteria in a school would serve chop suey every week. It was a very American thing.
Right, but the thing is, I'm not sure that that chop suey was similar to the mid-century chop suey, because, you know, so...
Was that just cabbage and meat?
Celery and meat and bean sprouts.
Chop suey can mean so many different things, and that's kind of what is sort of delightful about it, is that it is conceptually pretty amazing and pretty ingenious and inventive. As far as how they make it here, we'll have to find out.
I am happy to be both Chinese and American.
You are like the Chinese dish the Americans invented. What do they call it?
Chop suey.
That is it. Everything is in it, all mixed up.
I like that. Chop suey, chop suey. Living here is very much like chop suey. Hula hoops and nuclear war, Dr. Salk and Jar Jar Gabor, Bobby Darin and Sandra D and Dewey. Chop suey.
Chop suey.
So now I'm trying my first egg foo young.
So actually, I just wrote a mushroom egg foo young and mushroom gravy recipe for the Trib, which I'm very relieved that a lot of people wrote in and said that they were excited to try it and made it and really loved it, because it does hit a very specific, again, taste memory. So typically, egg foo young can be traced back to, again, we think the Canton, Guangdong region of southern coastal China, which I should add is, I often say, it's kind of like the New Orleans area of the U.S. and has a reputation as having some of the best food in China. And you'll find, actually, variations of egg foo young, this kind of omelet or frittata, if you will, throughout Asia. It's not just a Chinese-American thing. You'll find it in other hybrid Cantonese Asian foods. And so typically in Chinese-American restaurants, the way we used to make it is that you mixed your ingredients together. Typically, the main ingredients were egg and bean sprouts. And then in a ladle, lowered into a big, deep, hot wok full of oil, and then it would bubble up. It bubbles up like a souffle. Then it gets all crispy and golden brown in the outside, but it should still stay a little tender on the inside. And then the gravy, my recipe, which actually is at the Trib, it's super easy. And so basically what you take is either fresh shiitake or portobello mushrooms, which are really common now, which was not so common in the mid-century or late mid-century foods when these came up. And you saute those first. You season as you go along. You taste them. You add fresh bean sprouts and some egg, some scallions. You whip that up until it's frothy. And then in the bottom of a round bottom wok, you add, you know, a fair amount, like maybe 3 tablespoons or so of like either coconut oil or peanut oil. And then you let it bubble up and fry until it gets all nice and lacy and crispy around the edges. And then when it just barely sets on the bottom, you flip it over. And so it's not necessarily the round puffed patty that a lot of restaurants will achieve, because they have the benefit of the big, giant, deep woks full of oil. But I could not reasonably ask people to put like 2 gallons of oil or so into a wok. So you can do this actually with just like, you know, a round bottom wok. Or I heard back from people who use like an electric skillet. Just use a fair amount of oil and then you just flip it. And then also the gravy. And it's just simply a matter of seasoning enough with salt, pepper, soy sauce, and really not much more else. And it just makes a huge difference. Salt just makes a huge difference. It's really not that much more. Mine isn't so much necessarily a classic roux as much as it is a flour-based sauce rather than a cornstarch-based sauce. So mine, again, starts with sautéed mushrooms and then some flour, and also then a little additional fat in the form of either, again, coconut oil or peanut oil. Then that is essentially your roux base for your sauce. And then you add vegetable stock into it, and then you mix that up. And then you will have a little bit of like a slightly chunky mushroom-flecked gravy. And it's just a really simple sauce.
Chow mein and bowling, Twinkies and champagne, moon over McDonald's, frozen pizza in the rain.
Okay, here's my question, Monica. you wrote a story recently for the Chicago Tribune. We've been here talking. We're at a Chinese restaurant. We're enjoying the food. You wrote a really interesting story about the history of how, even though Chinese restaurants are more common, there's three times more Chinese restaurants in the U.S. than there are McDonald's. I learned that by reading your story.
Yes.
At one point in time, that almost was not the case, and it was because Chicago tried to outlaw them.
Yeah, there was a group of strange bedfellows, labor unions, unions that represented servers and bartenders, and Chicago legislators and state legislators across the nation were kind of freaked out by all the Chinese in the United States. And Chinese restaurants also weren't unionized. So they actually got some legislation pretty far. I mean, it was passed that would outlaw white women from entering Chinese restaurants, that would forbid restaurant licenses to anybody who wasn't who couldn't be naturalized and Chinese could not become citizens, so basically no Chinese restaurants, and that would stop Chinese from, say, opening restaurants or even doing any construction in certain parts of Chicago.
And when was this?
We're talking about 1909-ish. Up until about 1915, all these things were pretty much going strong.
People don't realize that's actually the origin of American immigration law, was to bar Chinese people from coming to this country. Those were like the first immigration laws that were ever passed in this country.
Right. I mean, there was this big yellow peril. There was this big scare about how many Chinese were coming here. So I had no idea that at the time, Chinese restaurants were considered a scandalous place. Going out on a chop suey date and going to a chop suey restaurant was considered akin to like going
scandalous?
To a rave. I talked to UC Davis law professor Gabriel Jack Chin, who you actually met, Nyla.
Yeah, I did. I met him in Champaign.
And he told me that it was a place of freedom, a place where women who were about to get the vote nationally, had already gotten in Chicago, felt like they did not have to necessarily follow the rest of the laws of society.
And they went to Chinese restaurants to do that?
Yes. So if you wanted to be free from the strict laws of society at that time, you went to a Chinese restaurant.
Just seems so crazy.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I mean, these are racist laws, basically saying that no Chinaman, quote unquote, could get a restaurant license, or that white women under the age of 21 years old couldn't enter one of these restaurants. Clearly, there was racism involved. But I do want to say that at the time, Chicago's Chinatowns were located near the Levee districts or the red light districts. And some of them did have ties to bars.
And there were a lot of Chinese gangs.
There were Chinese gangs, and opium was an issue in Chicago, not just in Chinese areas. But I will give that caveat. It didn't mean that you needed to bar any Chinese from ever getting a restaurant
license. It
didn't
mean that every chop suey restaurant was a drug haven.
Exactly. Although you can hear this sentiment when you listen to Louis Prima's song, Chop Suey Chow Mein, Tofu and You.
Chop suey chow mein, tofu and you. I've got the craziest yen to get you in a Chinese den, where I can whisper love words full of spice after we get full of tea and rice. Chop suey chow mein, tofu and you. I've got a feeling tonight that we'll be pretty clever if we ever get together with chop suey chow mein, rice and tea, shoes and rice and you and me. Chop suey chow mein, young one, tofu and you.
But then, later in that century, in 1915, after tons of case law had been established, after tons of, and you know there's this connection between the Chinese and the Jews, they love each other, but a lot of Jewish immigration lawyers had been working toward changing the rules about Chinese immigration. And there were four
categories.
Why? Well, because the Chinese wanted to keep coming in, and so they kept...
They were helping.
They were helping out. They were immigration lawyers. So there were four categories of people who would be allowed in under the Chinese Exclusion Act: students, diplomats, teachers, and merchants. But in terms of interpreting what a merchant meant, it was very, very loose. And initially, it did not include restaurant owners. But after tons of tries and after a lot of case law was established, finally in 1915, they established beyond a shadow of a doubt that a high-class Chinese restaurateur could gain entrance to the United States and actually go back and bring relatives. What would we call chain migration today?
But it was really expensive, quote unquote, yeah, chain migration.
Right. So you would have to show that you had a certain class of restaurant, and you had to have three white witnesses vouch for you, saying that you truly were the manager of the restaurant, that you did no menial tasks, you were not a worker.
And how much would it have cost in today's dollars to do this?
You know, I was seeing some estimates of about $100,000, $130,000
per restaurant.
Okay. And so I was also told that, you know, different immigration judges would be more lenient or less lenient depending on who you went to. But it was, you know, pretty much established you had to have a nice place or else you couldn't come in. And then, of course, you know, the three white witnesses rule that they had to vouch.
White men, I'm sure.
Right.
I'm sure it wasn't white women.
But once that happened, and once they said, okay, restaurateur is a category that will be let in and can go back and get workers, you saw a tripling of Chinese restaurants. Sometimes you saw a fivefold increase of Chinese restaurants in different communities. But you didn't want them all in the same community. So then you saw Chinese going to Oklahoma. I have some family who are out there, going to the South, going everywhere because you didn't want to have a ton of competition. So Chinese restaurants were spread out all over the United States, and everybody decided that they were a restaurateur now.
We didn't make a dent in this food. Not even, barely. It was good, though.
A lot of egg foo young left for Louisa.
Thank you for a lovely dinner, Louisa Chu, Monica Ng. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Now it's time to finish this chop suey.
We're not going to finish it. Now it's time to pack it all up and take it home.
Take out boxes.
Special thanks to Monica Ng, Louisa Chu, Lee's Chop Suey, and Robin Lin for producing that segment. We'll be back after a quick break here on the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Chicagoan Daniel Borsutski's latest book of poetry is called Lake Michigan. In two acts, it shares an unflinching picture of Chicago, with Lake Michigan as an imaginary prison that doesn't look that different from our existing criminal justice system. In two acts and 18 scenes, each individual pieces of poetry, it imagines this prison as privately run, racially segregated, and with an eye to the infamous torture that went on more than a decade in Chicago's police force under Commander John Burge, run by a brutal police force. Daniel's past work, The Performance of Becoming Human, won the 2016 National Book Award for Poetry. Lake Michigan is just out. If you're in the Chicago area, he has an event next week, Wednesday the 14th, at the Seminary Co-op to do a reading. He's with me now here in our studios at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. Daniel, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I guess the obvious question is to just ask you first, why Lake Michigan? Why something that's sort of seen as the jewel of the city being imagined? As I was reading your poetry more, it seems almost even more like a graveyard than a prison, just because of the amount, as you write in your poems, and I'm going to have you read one in a minute, just about the bodies that are ending up there.
Sure. For me, Lake Michigan, the lake itself, represents one of the great contradictions of Chicago. On the one hand, it's, of course, beautiful. And on the other hand, there are parts of it that are infected with E. coli. On another hand, it is a symbol of Chicago's kind of open access missions. And yet there are always kind of struggles around access to the lake and questions of who gets to use it. On a different level, there's something very artificial about how Lake Michigan, how the beach has been constructed, if I understand.
Right. It's not our sand.
It's
right?
not our sand. Right.
It's imported. I'm not sure quite from where, but right.
It's imported, I think, from Indiana. And then, if I understand as well, that the landfill under the grass along the lake comes from houses that on the west side of Chicago that were destroyed like in the 40s or something like that. So there's also this sort of embodied sense of urban decay that is happening at the lake at the same time. And I think it strikes me, too, that the lake is a very... Very symbolic of the many divisions that exist in Chicago. So on the one hand, there was the race riots that took place on the lake. And I think there's also questions of sort of who gets to enjoy access to the lake. You can speak to kids on the west side of the Chicago, who might tell you they've never been to the lake. And so for me, it's this very loaded place, both in its realness as well as in the many things it says about Chicago.
I wonder if you would mind reading some of your poetry for us. I was thinking about scene 3 from Lake Michigan. Would you mind reading that?
I would be happy to. Thanks. Lake Michigan, scene 3. The bodies are on the beach, and the bodies keep breaking, and the fight is over, but the bodies aren't dead. And the mayor keeps saying, I will bring back the bodies. I will bring back the bodies that were broken. The broken bodies speak slowly. They walk slowly onto a beach that hangs over a fire, into a fire that hangs over a city, into a city of immigrants, of refugees, of dozens of illegal languages, into a city where every body is a border between one empire and another. I don't know the name of the police officer who beats me. I don't know the name of the superintendent who orders the police officer to beat me. I don't know the name of the diplomat who exchanged my body for oil. I don't know the name of the governor who exchanged my body for chemicals. The international observers tell me I'm mythological. They tell me my history has been wiped out by history. They look for the barracks, but all they see is the lake and its grandeur, the flowering gardens, the flourishing beach. The international observers ask me if I remember the bomb that was dropped on my village. They ask me if I remember the torches, the camps, the ruins. They ask me if I remember the river, the birds, the ghosts. They say, find hope and hopefulness. Find life and deathlessness. locate the proper balance between living and grieving. I walk on the lake and hear voices. I hear voices in the sand and wind. I hear guilt and shame in the waves. I have my body when others are missing. I have my hands when others are severed. I hear the children of Chicago singing, "We live in the blankest of times."
That's Lake Michigan, Scene 3, by poet Daniel Borzutski. He's a Chicagoan. He's in studio with me here in Evanston as we're talking about his newest work that's just out. So I think as you read through this, and you can hear a little bit of that in that poetry, maybe I would call it a righteous indignation, or there's an outrage in your poems about the current condition of what's happening to children in Chicago, what's happening to undocumented immigrants. I know in the past we've talked about how much of your work is about the fact, so many people talk about the fact there are two Chicagos. I think you can expand that out, right, to say we're two countries in a way where some people are very removed from the violence. Some people are very removed from a lot of these things. And if you're not in contact with it on a day-to-day basis, or if it doesn't personally affect you, do you feel like it almost doesn't exist? Is that kind of where your outrage is coming from in your writing?
Well, yes, I think there. So I don't know if that's if I would say that's where the outrage comes from, but I think that's part of it. I think there are a lot of people who want to pretend that things don't exist. And if we sort of look at what's happened over the past year, on the one hand, we have the sort of constant cycle of Donald Trump distractions that prevent people from focusing. But on a different hand, we have things like Charlottesville, where we're literally having discourse about mainstream figures defending Nazis and white supremacists, right? We have literally been listening to the president describe the countries from which many people come from as using derogatory language. On the one hand, there's, you know, yes, perhaps a lack of recognition, but on the other hand, there's such a, we're at a moment where it's so kind of in our face all of the time that it's hard to understand the lack of recognition. But I think there's also a kind of strategy there involved of making that sense of disdain, let's say, for immigrants so public. It's baffling on the one hand, but it also sort of changes the discourse and makes us ask what it means when public figures are not afraid to say things that we think would be actually horrible and shameful.
So do you think for you that changes your discourse as a writer, as a poet? Does it almost like, I don't want to say like it ups the ante, but does it almost just sort of raise the volume of what you feel like you need to say?
So this book was started certainly before the Trump presidency. It was probably started in 2015 or so, but much of it was written between 2016 and the summer of 2017. And I did a lot of editing of the book at that time. And I feel the way in which it changed my approach was that there is a kind of directness here that I think I have not necessarily had in previous works. There's a kind of singular focus on Chicago in a certain way, and there is a a feeling of not wanting maybe wanting to match that rhetoric with a rhetoric which is as direct, let's say.
I'm speaking with poet Daniel Borzutski. His most recent work, which is just out, is called Lake Michigan. It imagines Lake Michigan, as we've been talking about all of these things, an imaginary prison is sort of the framework of this poetry. I wonder who you want to hear this. Like, who do you write for?
That's always a hard question in the United States, especially because I think poetry has such a limited audience. And that's actually very different. So, I mean, I have spent a lot of time in Latin America over the last year, and at literary festivals there, it's always kind of shocking that the number of people who come to things who have nothing to do with the literary world
In Latin America.
In Latin America. So recently I was in a poetry festival in Chile, a small press poetry festival, which takes place over a few days and which over 20,000 people came to in that time period, right? And that's just a very different relationship that the writer has to the public in that context. So here, the question of audience I find difficult because it's by nature so limited. I feel like this book is of course very much situated in Chicago. And if I were to kind of have conversations, I would love to like imagine it in the hands of young people who live in Chicago. I think that's one way of answering. I think the other thought that I'm having is that there's been so much kind of discussion about about street violence in Chicago, which is mostly blaming people who live in the communities in Chicago, right? And I think what Lake Michigan is doing is saying, yes, that violence exists, but it's also it's very much rooted in state policies and policing.
You also teach at Wilbur Wright. That's one of Chicago's city colleges. You have a lot of students who are undocumented. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of your writing is a reflection of what they're experiencing. And then I was also going to ask how much you think you teach them and how much is poetry an outlet for them?
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to say that it's biographical in that kind of way. But I think if we kind of step back from my immediate contact with people, I think what I am seeking to think about is certainly the situation of, and we heard this in the poem that I read, that this situation of what it means to be a person in this country who has come without any decision making, has come without power, and who has often come to the U.S. in a kind of cycle that has to do with U.S. policies. So if you're coming from Latin America to the United States, it's impossible to kind of separate the United States' relationship to Latin America and to think about the kind of cycles of policy and violence that occur that bring people here. I'm definitely thinking about the ways in which immigrants are talked about, are treated, are scapegoated, and are left with very little in terms of choices, I think.
There's a line from a Pablo Neruda poem that seems to influence you. Do you mind reading that?
Sure. This is from Pablo Neruda's poem, Explico Algunas Cosas. I explain some things from his poems about the Spanish Civil War. And in Spanish, the line is, Y por las calles la sangre de los niños corría simplemente como sangre de niños. And through the streets, the blood of the children ran simply like blood of children.
So I wonder, as you write and as your writing is in that style, so there's two things I wanted to ask you about. First, just the actual content of what he said. Mm-hmm. When you read that, did that make you think about Chicago?
Well, I don't know when I first read that, and my family is from Chile. So, but he's writing about the Spanish Civil War, but Neruda is from Chile. So I don't know that it makes me think about Chicago, but it makes me think about the ways in which we talk about the ways in which we talk about violence, the ways in which we talk about atrocity, and I think what he's ultimately getting at is that metaphor and simile fail us when we try to talk about something as horrible as children being killed in wars, right? And that to try to kind of in poetic or figurative language is to do that experience a disservice.
Daniel Berzutsky is a Chicagoan. He's a poet. He teaches. He's also a professor. He teaches at Wilbur Wright College, one of the city colleges of Chicago. His newest book of poetry is called Lake Michigan. Daniel, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you follow us on Twitter, search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. If you want to look for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.